Welcome to Nightlife, a bite-size episode.
For many Australians growing up, the Darryl Lee chocolate shops were the place to be for kids with a bit of pocket money to buy lollies. The colourful stores, with their female staff dressed in oversized smocks with impossibly large bows, were piled to the rafters with all sorts of lollies and licorice and chocolate and, of course, Rockley Road, the sweet bar that was synonymous with the shop's success. They were irresistible to many and the profits flowed accordingly. The Darryl Lee Empire was begun by a Jewish East Ender who forged a remarkable recipe for success. Darryl Lee was always a family affair, but the story behind the family is a dark one. In his new book, author Robert Wainwright tells the story of Montague Lee and his creative, bullying and eccentric wife, Valerie Everett. They had no less than seven children, of which three were adopted. But their trajectories in life were to be vastly different. Robert Wainwright joins me this evening. Robert, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Thanks for having me, Philip.
Darryl Lee began, the chocolate shop began from an unlikely source, wasn't it? An East Ender who was chancing his luck at almost anything before he happened on this. Just briefly, how did it start?
Well, I mean, Harry Levy, or Manessa Yablonovich, as his name actually was, reinvented himself many times, and he worked across Australia as a fossicker and an iron salesman, and he finally owned a fruit and vegetable shop on the Corso in Manly. But he found that in winter months nobody came, and he began selling or making Bulgarian sweets at home and selling them from the shop, and he found that they sold better than the fruit and vegetables, and he used to stack them up as you would apples or oranges, and then were very colourful sort of triangles or pyramids.
Stack them high and watch them fly.
Watch them fly was the great notion. So it developed from there, and selling them from the back of a cart and from a small shop between two cinemas in the Haymarket, and it grew into this amazing, iconic Australian company that, as you say, was essentially for most of its life a family concern.
Mm. Of course, it began its big flowering, didn't it, with the generation of Harry Levy's children, particularly Montague Lee. In fact, the whole Lee part of it was an anglicisation, wasn't it, of Levy, which he thought at one stage they needed a better name. In fact, the Darryl Lee was an even more curious beginning. Tell us how it was Darryl Lee.
Well, typically with these stories, there are various versions, but the one which is most colourful is that the brothers wheeled in their younger brother with them to go and lodge some new papers in a bureaucratic office in downtown Sydney, and the officer there thought it was rather boring that they were going to turn it into Levy Brothers. And he looked over the counter, saw the eight-year-old below and said, "And what's his name?" And he said, "Darryl." And they said, "Well, Darryl Lee, what a great name." And the brothers looked at one another and decided that they'd go with it. So Darryl, or Candy Lee, as he was known throughout his life, was the source of the name that we all know.
Mm. Yes. Montague Lee, the son, of course, is keen on the business, and he builds it quite successfully, doesn't he? He runs into what was called a ticket writer. That is, what you'd call them these days, I suppose, the same thing, a copywriter or a sign writer who was responsible for the colourful signs inside the shop announcing the prices and the virtues of each product. Her name was Valerie Everett. He falls hard for her, doesn't he? Not everyone in the family is happy about this. And tell me about the circumstances of their very odd early years of marriage.
Well, yes, clearly the Levy family was a Jewish family, and the Everett family was a Christian family, and neither the twain shall meet as far as the parents are concerned. Mm. And this one has a bit of a mystery about it, but essentially Valerie and Monty, who fell hard for each other, married in secret, and believe it or not, lived virtually separate lives for close to 7 years before they admitted to being married. And it was only when they moved to Melbourne and that they had to sort of come clean to the family that they were in fact hitched, and soon after had their first child. But it was This entire story is buried in identity and in all its facets, and it's incredible that not only we get to the children later on, but the family itself was reinventing and not sure of its own identity as it went along. So the relationship had a strange beginning, but it was a very loving marriage and successful marriage.
Yes, Monty and Valerie were seemingly in love and close for pretty much all their life. But let's talk about the children. Now, this is where it all gets rather weird. Valerie wants a big family, even though she's quite involved in the chocolate shop business and indeed is quite creative. She's the one that comes up with the smocks and the bows, for example, which become the uniform of the Daryl Lee shop assistants. She wants lots of children as well, though. So although she's quite heavily involved in the business, she also wants a large brood of children. Birth for her is not always easy. She has four children, and then she decides that she'll adopt three others, which she appears to go about in a quite businesslike fashion, doesn't she?
Well, everything about Valerie was pretty businesslike. Her natural children describe her this way too. She was an amazingly creative and wonderful person in many, many respects. And as you say, designed the iconic uniform. But she, I think, the reason appears to be that her grandmother, whom she doted on, had 14 children, and she got it in her head that that's what she wanted. As you say, she had a very difficult time with birth. She strangely gave birth every 2 years, 1942, 44, 46, 48. And in between years, she was pregnant, but she lost them all. She was involved in a car accident, and that sort of ended her chances of more children. But she didn't want to give up the idea, and then so she adopted one, then two, then three, and in fact there was a fourth who didn't last long. And it was a sense that this was something inside her that was important, and this was a way to achieve it in her very businesslike fashion, and she felt as though she could knit those two sides of her life together, side by side, being a mother of a large family and being the focus of a business empire. And that's where things began to come unstuck.
They did come unstuck, because it turns out, from your book at least, that Valerie wasn't necessarily capable of showing, in fact, certainly wasn't capable of showing equal love to all the children. That she formed a dislike, an intense dislike of one of them, Shelton, of course, who went on later to become a poet after many difficulties in life. The social welfare department get involved with Shelton's behaviour and conclude that the problem is Valerie, don't they?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think Valerie believed that she loved the children equally. It was later on that she sort of began to admit through her diaries that in fact, she struggled. But she saw it in a very simplistic fashion, that she's providing children who would otherwise be in an orphanage with a school, a great schooling, a warm house, nice clothes, toys, etc. And that's what love means. And in fact, as we know, that's not necessarily the case.
No.
And in fact, it's very hard to love other children as much as your own. I mean, she was also under the thrall of her own mother, Munger, who was a fascinating character herself, who believed that blood was everything. So she was contorting herself and her beliefs, her actions didn't speak of what she thought she was doing. And as they grew into teens, of course, and teenagers can be troubling, and you had three teenagers who didn't really know who they were because they weren't real Lees.
Well, they were told they weren't.
They struggled.
They were told that they weren't real Lees, weren't they? But, yeah. I mean, just reading now, you think, how could this be allowed to happen? But they were told that they weren't real Lees, that they weren't really part of the family at all. And in Shelton's case, there appeared to be an active dislike of him by Valerie.
Yeah, well, he struggled more than the others. He was also more willful, but a willful teenager is still a child.
Mm.
And in fact, she had plenty of information, and she was a great reader. She was a convert of Dr. Spock, and she had all the information in front of her. But she chose to ignore the fact that what Shelton needed was her love, and perhaps she didn't understand what that meant. But it simply isolated him further, and eventually he just went off on his own. And the other children had their own difficulties with identity and with their relationships with Valerie. And ultimately, they all left as teenagers, which she, instead of realising that, in fact, she was culpable, at least to some degree, she was angry at that, and she felt that she had been cheated and that they didn't deserve anything.
Mm. I'm talking with Robert Wainwright, author of Rocky Road, the incredible true story of the fractured family behind the Darryl Lee chocolate empire. Because the Darryl Lee company, of course, was family owned and run. They were very wealthy. The shops at their height were making a stack of dough. The treatment of the children, though, was weird, wasn't it? All seven of them, the four natural children, and the three adopted children, were sent to seven different schools.
Yeah.
Was she thinking?
I think her stated thought was that she didn't think it was right for them to be compared to one another. So if they all went to the same school, that ones who didn't achieve very well might be compared to older ones and go through a hard time. So again, it's about identity. Where she got this idea, I don't know. But her household, already run by paid staff to actually feed and help with the children, suddenly had seven different uniforms, seven different schools, seven different ways to get to school every morning. So an already complicated family life was made even more complicated by this notion of comparison, because she adopted her children to be playmates for one another. The worst way of viewing this is that the adopted children were simply human playthings, toys.
Mm.
That might be overly harsh, but the notion was that the four-year-old girl was a playmate for her four-year-old daughter, and the six-year-old boy was a playmate for the six-year-old natural son. And so when this was no longer needed, they were sort of their use was over with.
Mm. Yeah, indeed, and that that comes through very strongly from the story of Valerie and indeed the natural children. This whole idea of blood in the family gets weirder and weirder too, doesn't it? Because the three adopted children are left nothing. The four natural children all get shares in the company upon the death of the previous generation, but the three adopted children get absolutely nothing. And strangely, this appears to be a decision that's supported by some of the natural children themselves, and which is not as a decision supported just out of greed, too. Explain what went on there.
Well, again, Mungo is a very powerful character. This is Valerie's mother, and she, in fact, created a fortune of her own by owning houses around Petersham and Stanmore in Sydney. And the notion was that only the natural-born children were owed anything, and the adopted children had already, I suppose, been given something by being given a chance in life. But life's not as easy as that. And then when they all left as teenagers, ran away from home, Valerie didn't take it very well, and that was really the time when she decided, if not before, that they would get nothing. And the truth is that the children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren of the Lees enjoy a comfortable life now. They've shared something like $80 million thereabouts in the carve-up of the family company. But there is still one of the adopted children still alive who lives on a pension on the north coast of New South Wales, has never received a penny in her life and struggles and is still traumatised by this childhood at the age of 73.
Mm.
She is not a greedy person, but the worst thing she ever did in life was that she had the audacity to leave home at 16, and it was never her choice to actually come into this household in the first place.
No. No, and any notion of responsibility, in a way, towards those children seems to have just disappeared. As I say, the natural children all seem to support this as well. There seem to be some quite extreme attitudes towards family members in the book. I mean, tell me what a subsequent generation, Jason Lee, said about his son, for example?
Well, Jason was the oldest of the natural children, and he at one point was the chief executive, Darryl Lee, and he sacked his brother, younger brother Lale, and he also sacked his own son, Jason Jr. Mm. Jason Jr. had a troubled upbringing. There was another generation where there was a marriage split, and instead of the mother taking the children, she was sent packing off to England, and instead Valerie raised the three grandchildren. And there was a traumatised notion in there because of identity too, and I don't think you can blame somebody for all this, but the truth is that these children had traumatic lives, and the relationship between Jason and his father was fraught from this moment onwards, and ended very terribly. And in fact, it was shown on the ABC Dynasty program about a decade ago, and it was as the older Jason Senior was dying of leukemia, and the family was still bitter and twisted and hated one another. It was a very sad sort of explosion internally.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. Money might buy many things, but it doesn't. It didn't in this instance buy love. That seems to be for sure. The Darryl Lee Empire itself, of course, eventually kind of collapsed under its own weight, didn't it? It seems that it had an awful lot of shops. The turnover wasn't there, and it had probably, in a way, gone out of fashion. Had it in the end?
Well, it's come back and it's thriving now under new owners, but the which is a very strange situation. Mm. But its strength in the 1930s, which was its marketing was superb, it targeted itself at the middle classes, lower middle classes perhaps, were less moneyed, and it was bright and colourful stores, and people going home would buy chocolates for their families, and it was very, very personable sort of business, hands-on business, and it worked in showbag halls across the Australia.
Mm.
But with the advent of supermarkets and of shopping, of big shopping centres and of modern technology and overseas competition, all these things piled over the top of a small family-run company, and their answer was to try to expand with it and change with it. And in doing so, they changed their whole business profile from a very structured cash-based business to one which then loaned a lot of money, and it got itself into trouble when production sort of seized, and as you say, styles changed. So it was a victim of its own success in some ways, but also of changing times and technology.
Yes, well, the family story, as I say, is a rich one. I'd love to spend all night talking about it, but because there are so many highways and byways of this story. But it's a terrific effort. Robert, it's been a pleasure talking with you. The book is called Rocky Road, The Incredible True Story of the Fractured Family Behind the Darryl Lee Chocolate Empire. Robert Wainwright's been our guest this evening. Robert, great to talk with you.
Thanks, Phil. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.